Welcome to the first episode of Breaking the Silence, a News Talk original podcast in conjunction with the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Over the next six episodes, we're going to share survivors' stories and hear from experts, all to help us better understand the aftermath of a sexual assault. This week, we're joined by Charlene Masterson, who was blackmailed and sexually abused by her father for over 7 years, along with DRCC CEO Rachel Morrow. Charlene, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much.
How did you feel this morning, kind of getting ready, thinking about coming in here to talk about this again?
I think I have so much to say on it. We could be here for hours. So apologies in advance. It's always nerve-wracking, I think, or not even nerve-wracking, but kind of there's a certain line of trepidation maybe around it, because it obviously isn't your run-of-the-mill conversation, maybe. And I know it can be awkward or difficult for people to ask me questions on it. So I don't know, how are you feeling?
You're amazing to think of me in this, because I was just thinking of you in preparing for this. Like, I think it's amazing that you're going to talk about what isn't a story, it's your life,
yeah,
in order to help other people. But I often think with something traumatic, when you go back there, you're bringing yourself back to some very dark feelings and times, and that's challenging. So I really appreciate you being willing to do this, because I know it will help other people. Is that what motivates you to do so?
Yeah. Even if you can help one person, you've kind of done your job, or you've done your duty. And I think that was always my goal, was to help at least one person.
Well, I think you're very brave.
Thank you.
Very brilliant. And it's a real honour for me to hold space for you today. So do not worry about me. Let's go back then to Charlene growing up as a child. What are your memories of then?
It was a very normal childhood. I was the only grandchild on my mum's side for 13 years. So I was the one and only. I was the favourite, not going to hide it. Absolutely the favourite. I was one of 13 on my dad's side. So not so much the favourite there. I did every kind of after school activity you could imagine. First aid, swimming, drama, dance. And yeah, it was just a run of the mill, normal, busy childhood.
You were saying before we started to record that you're involved in musicals and theatre.
Yeah.
Were you always into performing as a child?
From the age of 9, I started kind of stage performing. I joined a variety group, but I danced. I did ballroom and Latin from the age of 3 until I was about 21. So I've always been active, but dance and singing is definitely my number ones. Let's put it that way.
So busy, but did you still feel like you had got to have that innocent childhood?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. My mum would have taken me out a lot, and she was busy and she was working. But I always remember when I wasn't in an activity, we were out somewhere, whether it be the cinema, the beach, wherever. We were always doing something. I don't really remember a time in the house, as in spending time at home. It was always just busy, busy and fun and just enjoying life, really.
So at what point did things change for you?
A month after my 18th birthday, I started getting random messages from a stranger. One thing to kind of note is that I was a very, very good kid, probably too good at times. So to think I was in trouble at any point would have kind of sent me into a spin. So for someone to say, you know, I know what you've been doing, or I know what you've done, I just instantly went to panic. And I know people, I've read stuff on social media, of course, which is just such a lovely place to be sometimes, of how did she not know who it was, or those types of questions. And you just don't, because you never would think who it was who it was. And that's kind of my main thing, is it was a stranger, I thought, demanding things, and I would have never have thought that it was my dad, and that was who it turned out to be. So when people say, how did you not know, why would I know, or why would I even think that that was the possible outcome, as an only child, like I was his one and only. So it really wouldn't have even entered my head that it could be my dad, but it was.
And what was life like for you around that time? So you were 18. Were you
dating?
Were you socializing?
I was doing my Leaving Cert. So I was in the middle of like my mock exams or my oral and practical exams. I was very good in school, but I wouldn't cope with exam stress very well. So I would have been quite unwell at the time. And this just really added to the stress, I suppose. I would have still been active with my activities, especially with dance and stuff, but I didn't have a part-time job. I remember my mom always said, you know, you're long enough working, when you're finished school is time enough to be getting a job and whatever. Yeah, so it would have been just school stress and exam stress and all that sort of stuff. And then that turned into college life, where I did get a part-time job, but didn't make things any easier or better in the situation.
So do you remember where you were when that first text message came through?
I don't particularly, but it could have been like, I remember getting messages like in school or on the way to dance rehearsals or on the bus or wherever. Not so much when I was at home, which hindsight now makes total sense, but it would have always been when I was out of the house. So I was obviously with other people or sometimes maybe by myself. So it was always something that I hid very well from people outside of the house, my mom included, really, to be honest. I did eventually go to my dad looking for help in the hope that it would be the end of it. But of course, that didn't happen.
So what were the text messages saying?
Amora, I know what you've done. Now, obviously, again, hadn't done anything, but being a kid that never got into trouble, I didn't know what to do with that information or with that kind of accusation. So, of course, I did retaliate with, I didn't do anything and I don't know what you're talking about, but it was a persistent, I know what you did. And then they obviously had information on my dad and where he worked and his boss's name and all of this information that I didn't even know at the time. So that was obviously quite alarming because I didn't know it. So how could somebody else know that information? So it was just demanding certain things, that I meet people and in my house and do sexual acts with them and all this sort of stuff. And that was kind of when I went to my dad and I was like, look, I haven't done anything. But he didn't have the response that I had hoped.
What was his response?
You have to do it, was essentially. I don't remember the words, but that was essentially the gist of it, which was obviously not what I was hoping for or expecting.
And I can imagine the chill that would run through you when you would receive these text messages and the panic that you must have been feeling to think, is somebody watching me? What's going on here? So then to think this was your safe place and have the ground completely crack beneath you.
Yeah.
You must have been stunned.
I was terrified. And the person on the other end of the messages knew where I was. Like, I know you're going to your grandmother's house, or I know you're going here. So that was terrifying in itself, regardless of what they were asking for. But even just to feel like someone is watching you at all times is pretty terrifying.
So what happened after this conversation where your dad suggested you go along with what this texter was suggesting?
The requests basically happened. There was a number of kind of conditions within it, which was, you know, essentially unidentifying. So I wouldn't be able to identify who was there. So I had to have like earphones in my ears and I had to be blindfolded. And there was, of course, the other items, which was like dress a certain way and do X, Y, and Z. And my dad relayed the fact that he would be there at all times to make sure I was safe. Not in the room, but just in the house to make sure I was safe. And that happened a good few times over the space of, I think it was a year and a half to 2 years roughly before I found out it was actually him.
And what do you remember about that time? I mean, the timings of it being hazy, did you have to begin to disassociate to be able to manage your way through that?
I think I remember after each kind of organized meetup that I really just tried to be normal. And I know that's something my father absolutely tried to do. Like, we would go out for food afterwards, which was just so bizarre. And it was just, he acted as if nothing had happened, or he acted like it wasn't such a big deal. And I think, like, for me, it was a huge deal, because these meetups or arrangements, that would have been my first sexual encounter of any kind. Up to that point, I had only maybe kissed a boy. So it was a big, big deal. And that's something that was obviously taken away, that, and not everyone enjoys their first time. That's not what I'm saying. But as in, the choice to be my first time was obviously taken. And it was physically paralyzing, I would say, is the word I would use. Like, I don't remember, ever being distressed in it in a physical way. So I wasn't kicking or screaming or anything like that. But I just remember being physically paralyzed and crying every time and all the time. And it just didn't faze him at all.
And you're so young. I mean, I know we say 18, 19, you're an adult, but you're still an absolute baby.
And I was naive. I was a very naive teenager. I was a very naive kid. I wasn't street smart whatsoever, because I didn't hang around the streets. I was too busy. But I didn't go drinking with my friends when I was a teenager. I didn't do any of that. I think I went to a nightclub once when I was 18, and that was purely because I was 18. And then I wasn't ID'd going in. I was raging. They didn't ask me for ID. But I was a very, very naive kid. And I was a kid, you know.
And as you say, those first sexual encounters for a teenager are usually something that are discussed with
your friends. And Jesus, do you remember? Like, I thought it was really embarrassing. I don't have any of that. Even still, I don't have any of those stories. I didn't have, like, I lost the first 7 years of my adult life because of this. And there's more than just time has gone. Like, there's experiences and lived experiences that are taken when something like this happens.
So there's no making sense of it, but no. Was your making sense of it that this was to stop the blackmailer?
Yeah.
And that if your dad thought it was okay, it must be okay? Or were you able to even have any cognizance around that?
I'm not sure I had cognizance completely, but for me it was like, I don't want to call it a mission, but this was for a purpose. And like, my dad was there to protect me. So like, nothing bad was going to happen. Yes, it was a horrible situation, but nothing horrendous was going to happen because he was there. And if it was really like, if I was in danger, if I felt in danger at any time, like, I could scream, he's there, like, it's absolutely fine. But it just never ended. It just continued. And every time I thought, okay, this is the last one and I've done everything they've asked, there was always more. So it just, yeah.
And would that be via text message?
Yeah. And when I think back, like, my dad was never in the room when I got a text message. So obviously, hindsight, fantastic. But again, I would never put two and two together there. There was never a question, because obviously my dad would stop this if he could. So the fact that it continued, he obviously couldn't stop it. So I had to do what was asked to protect him. It wasn't to protect me, but to protect him and his job. And
yeah. That. And I think we do often focus in on why does somebody do this and why. And it's not about you. Why would somebody allow this to happen to you is where our focus should go.
And that's
the reason for this conversation.
Yeah.
So I'm not asking you so that you defend yourself.
Yeah.
I just want to put ourselves back into where your head was at that time.
Yeah.
And how were you managing to live these two parallel lives outside of these occasions? How were you?
Not great. I definitely started to pull back from my friends and stuff. And I always remember my best friend in the entire world was also going through something at the time. And I didn't know. She didn't know about me, obviously. And she completely pulled back. So I lost my best friend as well, all in the space of like 6 months. This had all happened. And obviously life was changing. I was finishing school and I was going to college. And it was just, there was so much change that I don't even think I recognized the extremities of what was physically happening to me, because all of this other stuff, my leaving cert, everything was just, life was just mental for those six to 8 months. And then obviously I didn't have school. I was an adult now. I was in college. So it was just a bigger world that I just seemed like such a small entity of the world or the outside world. So.
And you were carrying this big secret, and there must have come a lot of shame and guilt that you shouldn't have had to feel, but you must have been carrying that all that time.
Yeah, it's not a really nice feeling to carry, but even the feeling of, well, I can't tell anybody because one, maybe no one would believe me, or two, if they did, that would cause trouble for my family. So I'm like, I don't want to do that. So it's very much that I would rather carry it than anyone know. And I still think I kind of have that feeling because obviously life is harder when people know, but it's no more harder for me because it's probably slightly easier for me that people know, but it's harder for other people. And I see that in like my friends or my family, that it is harder for people to know about it.
What about your mom in this situation? And I only ask because I'm sure people will think, how could this happen in the house and somebody not know about it? But I'm not in any way placing her in any sort of dock with that question.
Yeah, of course. Mom was and always will be, I think, the hardest working person I've ever known in my life. And when I was 23, I think, so we're talking maybe 5 years into the abuse, my granddad took really ill and went into hospital, and he was in hospital for 2 years. So the abuse really ramped up when that happened because she was out of the house most evenings. But before that, mum would have worked really late, maybe 9, 10 at night. And I know she has a lot of guilt around this, but frankly, and it's something I always say, had my mum been in the house 23 hours of the day, he'd have gotten to me in that last hour. And that's something that I think everyone needs to recognize, is that where there's a will, there's a way. They will find a way to get to you regardless. So my mum could have protected me and kept me in a room for half the day. He still would have got to me. It's not. And I think that's really important for like family members of survivors, is that they don't carry blame unless they obviously knowingly facilitated it. But mom had no idea. And with the information that she did know, which I kind of played down to, oh, he's just on my case all the time. You know, he's just text messaging me, or he's texting me and wanting to know where I am. Mom confronted him a number of times with what she knew. So I have no doubt, and actually it was proven when she did find out the extent of it, 30 minutes later, he was gone. You know, it was never a question of mom didn't do anything. She did what she could with the information that she had. So mum would always confront him, you know, leave her alone, stop being on her case. And I remember the last time she did that, I woke up, like, we're talking middle of the night, like 2, 3 in the morning, and his face was literally nose to nose with mine in my bed. And he said, you didn't think that would stop me. So I just didn't tell her after that. So I really had to ramp up the mask at that point. But that was like, I said, nothing is going to change this. So I stopped telling her then after that.
And let's just remember, she was, I want to be really careful with my language.
Okay.
I want to say leaving you, but not leaving you. You were at home with your dad.
Yeah.
Who would suspect that there would be anything unsafe about that?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to ask how your relationship with her and how you were managing all of that at that time. Again, not to suggest that your mom should have stepped in any earlier.
Oh, no. It's not that. It's like mine and mom's relationship absolutely took a hit during that time. Because it was, so I never went through like the hormonal teenager phase. I was always really pleasant. But then obviously not being able to probably come to terms with or equate or keep all my feelings in, I became this moody teenager in my 20s, which was so bizarre for her. So our relationship obviously dwindled slightly because I was nearly trying to avoid talking to her in any way, just out of pure fear of letting something slip or whatever. But thankfully, it's probably the best it's ever been since he left. And, you know, we talk about things and we can have proper conversations and it's lovely. And it's kind of something that I do really regret, is that we didn't have that in like my early adult years. But that's purely because of everything that was going on.
Yeah. And also you did the best that you could in the situation with what you had.
Yeah.
What about your relationship with your dad before you knew he was involved in this? Were you getting to a point where you were saying, Dad, I don't want to keep doing this? Was that a discussion?
Yeah, I mean, I did have that a number of times, but it was always the, you have to, you know, this is my job. We're talking about it's our life and this could break up the family. And all these typical things that you would hear from an abuser is, you know, what about me is the narrative. And frankly, I shouldn't have cared about him that much. But in that time, like my mom and dad were really all I had. So you would do anything to protect them. So I didn't care really that it was me suffering as long as he didn't have to. It's kind of a double-edged sword, really.
And were you able to carry on as normal in college? Were you starting to get out and socialize, or did it make you hold back in certain situations?
Before I found out that it was him, I was able to socialize and, you know, enjoy college life. Don't tell my mom, spend most of first year in the pub next to, I don't even drink, but I spent most of my first year dossing in the student union and, you know, normal first year things. But after I found out that it was him, yeah, no, I stopped my hobby. My full-time job was gone, or my part-time job, should I say. I stopped socializing because it was just easier. It was not a nice situation to come home to. Like, I could come home at 3-4 in the morning from being out and he'd be still up. And I'd be quizzed about who I spoke to and was I talking to any boys or this sort of stuff. And it just wasn't worth it. It just really wasn't worth it. So I just gave up. What's the point?
So when did you find out that it was your dad orchestrating this whole thing?
Roughly about 2 years after it started. That could be factually incorrect, but that is what I envisage in my head, that it went on for about 2 years. He had brought home his mother's laptop to our house to install software. And I'm going to equate it to like summertime because I wasn't in college or anything. It was during the day and he was in work. He was on early shift. And I said, sure, I'll install the software while I'm sitting doing nothing. And I opened this case with this rack with discs on it. And I saw these two discs at the very front of the rack and they were just like squiggly lines in a blue marker. No name. And I was like, oh, I wonder what they are. And I popped them into the DVD in the laptop and it was the first encounter. It was the recording of the first encounter and it was my dad on the screen. I didn't get to the second DVD and I didn't watch any further. I did eject straight away and put everything back. But yeah, it was about 2 years after that I found out it was him.
I mean, can you even put into words how you felt in that moment?
I remember just crying. And I don't think there was any volume to my tears. It was just, they just flowed. I remember him coming home and going up for a lie down because he'd been in work really early. And I then started getting messages again. And I said it there and then. I was like, look, I know the person's my dad. And within 3 seconds, he shouted from upstairs. And I just got this list of how would you think I would do that to you? How dare you think I could do that? Really gaslighting what I had just seen. And I had physically seen it with my own two eyes. I knew what I saw, but it was this just campaign of how could you think, how dare you think I could do that? And making me out to be somehow in the wrong. I don't know how that mentally that works in their head, but that's the way it came across. I never got another message, however, from the blackmailer. So it's not that clever. You know, the texting stopped straight away. And then I don't know how it transferred to just open abuse from him. I still don't remember how that transitioned, but it did. And it continued then for 5+ years.
Yeah, because that whole mask or scheme that he had been using was gone. So, I mean, not to be glib about it, all bets were off. So everything ramped up.
Yeah, he didn't care. He didn't care after that. You know, he started portraying us as a couple and requesting men to come and meet us and all this sort of carry on. So that was another added entity to this story. And that went on for, that was probably the worst part of it. I know it's all not great, but, you know, being sent pictures of men when you're in a lecture in college or when you're in a part-time job is just not, it's not cool.
And you try to carry on with life as normal. I mean, part of you must have just been in absolute shock.
I was so exhausted.
Sleepwalking through life.
Yeah. And he used to argue through text message. So it was very rare, unless obviously if we were in the house on our own, it would be a physical interaction or altercation. There was violence involved sometimes. But if I went to bed or if he was in work or I was out, it was all through text message and it was just constant. And if I didn't respond or I didn't respond straight away or whatever, there was, you know, consequences or hell to pay.
So was there a rock bottom moment where you decided you couldn't do this anymore?
Yeah. It was actually the weekend that my mom found out. He had just reached a point where he didn't care who was around, who heard anything, any sort of interaction between us. I was taking part in a dance show, and my friend was the teacher, the dance teacher in the school also. And she knew. I hadn't told her, but she knew. And she was on my case, and he didn't like her. I think because he knew that she knew. Now, it turns out he had my phone tracked. I found that out afterwards. So he was seeing all messages, all text messages. So he knew that she was on my case. But my other friend was staying in our house that weekend, and she was in my bedroom in bed. And I was in the sitting room with him because I'd been summoned. And my bedroom was just above the sitting room. And he had me up against the wall by my throat, screaming into my face. And he just didn't. He reached a point where he didn't care. So he's going to kill me, or I'm going to do it to myself, because I can't. I couldn't. And it was actually during COVID, myself, my mom were out for a walk, and we were just talking about it. And I said, I don't know what I would have done during lockdown if this was still going on. And my mom actually said, you wouldn't have been here. You wouldn't have still been here. And that was the first time I realized that she completely understood where I was at that time. That was nice to hear, which is so bizarre to say, but I kind of never really thought my mum 100% got it, or wanted even to acknowledge that that was the point I was at. But yeah, I absolutely wouldn't still be here.
So what did you do?
My friend that knew, she was actually moving country 2 weeks later, and it was probably a ride or die situation. It was, I need to sort this before I leave, because probably my friend's not going to be here if I ever come back. And it was a Sunday, and my dad was in work. So he was on the late shift. So he was in work till about midnight. And my friend texted me and she said, you need to come over. She was living with another friend of mine. And she said, you need to come over here. And I was like, I can't. And she said, well, you come over or I'm coming to you. So I was like, well, I can't, you know, I can't have that. And we sat in her back garden for probably 6 hours talking absolute crap. I was just avoid, avoid, avoid. And around about 11 o'clock, I said, right, I better go home, work in the morning. And she said, well, you're not leaving until you tell me what you need to tell me. And of course, I was just, don't need to tell you anything. Don't know what you're talking about. And she said, right, I'm just going to ask you questions. And she said, is your dad abusing you? And I just said, yes. And it was literally that. It's that cut and dry, that simple. And then the next day she told my mom. So it really was that straightforward, not straightforward, but that quick.
And how incredible to have allies in your corner, the lady at the dance school, people noticing a change in your behavior or overhearing
something. Massively, yeah.
And helping you to speak out, because it must be so difficult to reach out for help in the midst 100%. Of something like that.
Because you always have that narrative that no one's going to believe you. I genuinely didn't think anyone would believe me, because it's such a bizarre story. I don't think it's your run-of-the-mill abuse story. And for it to go on for so long, I understand people saying, why didn't you say anything? It is so difficult when you're in that situation. And had my friend not asked me, I don't think I would have ever spoken. And I know I wouldn't have ever gone to court or anything. If I could have gone to the grave without telling my mom the details, I absolutely would have. But in order to stop from doing it to anyone else, there had to be something I had to give.
So you said after your mom found out, he was gone within half an hour.
Yeah.
Were you there
No.
for that happening?
No, I stayed in my friend's for a couple of days after that. I just didn't want to go back to the house, because obviously that's where everything happened as well. You know, she rang him, and I think maybe he thought that she just thought he was on my case again. And then he said, oh, I'll get help. And she said, you put your hand on my child, get out of the house. And he was gone within 30 minutes. And I didn't see him again then for a year, I think, or over a year.
And you mentioned there the court case.
Yeah.
When did that begin to become a reality?
He left in 2014. I want to say like 2018. No, 2017 maybe. Because I was 2 years giving statements. And then it was with the DPP for a year and a half. And then 6 months later, we had our first court date.
And to go from your friend knowing, somebody knowing, your mom knowing, to then having to include people like the police.
Yeah.
How does that feel and how does that play out?
I know giving my statements, 90% of it I was only saying for the first time out loud. So I hadn't told even my friends that knew, didn't know the full extent of it. So that's quite surreal. And obviously when you give a statement, they write it down and then they read it back to you. So you're also hearing it then for the first time, which is so just bizarre. And it is really tough. And the sessions for giving your statement are so long. Like I remember one Saturday I was there for 8 hours. And they constantly ask, do you want a break? I'm like, no, just keep going. Because if I stop, it's probably not going to start again. At that point, you do want to scream it from the rooftops because you are finally able to speak your truth or whatever, but you can't because of the court case. You just want to tell everybody. But I also know anonymity was a massive factor. It was a massive discussion point at home. I knew it was something I needed to do or more wanted to do because I constantly got comments of, well, he's still your dad, with people that knew. And I just, it's the most damaging comment I think you can get. You know, it's, he's not. From the day he laid his hand on me, he wasn't my dad. You know, it's a massive stigma. He's still your family member. No, I don't. I can't. I'm allergic to that.
People said that to you out loud.
Yeah. See? Bizarre.
No, what you just said is exactly what went through my head. He stopped being your dad when he began to harm you rather than protect you. 100%. I mean, not that so many things you've told me have shocked me.
That is.
And they're the kind of things you have to take on. But during that process, was it beginning to crystallize for you that you were a victim in this, that you did not do anything wrong here?
Now, I did have, there's still some guilt in. So when he left our house, he went on to abuse other people and he was arrested and charged for that and imprisoned for that. But I always have this, God, if I had have just kept my mouth shut, he wouldn't have gotten to anyone else. So there is sort of that underlying guilt for me. And I think there always will be. But that's my empathetic, my crippling empathy that I have sometimes. But I know in my situation, like there wasn't anything I did wrong. He is just not a well person. It's a nice way to put it. But,
and as you say, that's just your own beautiful heart. That was not your responsibility.
Yeah.
That was his. That was nothing to do with you speaking out. And because you have spoken out, there are plenty of people you saved, and you've every right to save yourself in this situation. Yeah. Were you supported through the process of giving statements and the legal?
Oh, God, yeah, 100%. I did do the statements all by myself. I got two incredible detectives from the Gardaí, a man and a woman, and I was actually the woman that took all my statements, which was great. It's just easier. I don't know why. But I had incredible support from the Gardaí, which I know is not everyone's experience, but it should be. Everyone should have the experience that I had. And I hate using this term, but I was very, very lucky in this entire process. I was lucky even in relation to a sentencing, which when you break down the sentencing for people, they're quite shocked as to what the actual sentence is. But I am very, very lucky in my outcome and my experience with it all. And I'm very, very conscious that others have not had such an experience. But I got such great support, especially around the court. It was actually the Gardaí put me in touch with the DRCC. And they were literally the biggest pillar of strength through the entire thing. I had a court accompaniment, a lady from their court accompaniment section, and Nolene Blackwell, who was the CEO at the time, who's just, I don't know, she needs to be sainted or something. She's just incredible. She was there with me through all the media and all of that sort of stuff. And I just had a really pleasant, if I can even use that word in this circumstance, but a really pleasant experience. But I think that should be the case for everybody.
And I think it is important that you highlight that, because how important is it to be believed and be supported?
Massively. And I think, and I hate saying it here because you guys work in media, but I think the written media are absolutely to blame for people thinking they will not be believed. And it's all down to the headlines. Literally a simple headline and the way it's worded can be so damaging or so triggering for victims. You always see the, you know, doctor accused of rape or sexual assault or whatever it is. But it's like, no, it's a man. So what if he's a doctor? It doesn't matter. He's a man. And it's even, it might seem so simple and so non-trivial for anyone that hasn't experienced it, but stuff like that can be just so harmful to people. And you see it all the time on social media with comments under stories. The rapist is never questioned. The victim is always, always questioned. And that is so toxic. The rapist is never, ever questioned in their actions or why they did that. It's always, well, why did she do this? Why was she there? Why was she wearing that? Why did she do something? And that is just the most toxic environment. And I think that's why there's so many survivors speaking out, because we really want to change that stigma, essentially.
100%. And very conscious, even as I was asking them.
Oh, no, go. I'm an open book. Here you go.
So you could tell your story, you know, but to say, why didn't you tell somebody?
Yeah.
Because you were in shock. Your father was abusing you. You know, it shouldn't be in question. Did you look at things like that? Did you see comments on your 100%. Case?
And I've totally.
And headlines.
I've spoken to so many survivors since I waived my anonymity, and we all have the same kind of experience in a why would someone believe us? Whereas I think the question should, why would someone question us? You know, and I've seen it so many times in recent cases, especially, and some of the high profile cases that have happened, of people going, yeah, well, she performed in this way afterwards, and she's seen with him afterwards. Because you will do whatever it takes to survive that situation. And if that is pretending that you love the ground he walks on, you will do that. I did it for 7 years. I had to pretend I loved my dad. You know, I had to pretend I was living in a happy life. And that's just not. But you will do whatever it takes to get out of that situation or to survive it. And I think that's something that people really need to think about before they comment.
So let's go back to the anonymity, although I love what you said there. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, 100%. The anonymity, was that a big decision for you? You had the right, if you wanted, to go through this anonymously, but yeah, you chose not to.
Yeah, I chose not to for a couple of reasons. One was so that he could be named. And obviously, if there is a close relationship to a perpetrator, if they're named, they're going to find out who you are. But I think I wanted to run my narrative on my story. Whereas I think if you don't, and this is obviously not pressuring anyone to waive anonymity, it's a really, really difficult decision. I don't ever want to make light of it. But I wanted to make sure my side of the story was told, and it wasn't just what people had heard in the media or on the news or what a reporter that was in the court that day heard. And I've seen a number of, I find it really funny, it's probably not funny, but I've read stories in the past, articles on me and my story. And there's, where was the mother? And I'm always so vocal about where my mom was and why there was no intervention from my mom and that there was when she knew. Or I read, well, her mother was dead. And I'm like, no, she's not. I only saw her this morning. You know, and it is that people will make up or hear what they want to hear. But I wanted to make sure that I told it from my own words. And I was, because I was waiving, I was able to do like pre-record news interviews and stuff for the day that the anonymity was waived. So I could drive that narrative and just make sure that my mom was safe. And, you know, like my mom's a hairdresser, and I didn't want her to be doing someone's hair and they say, oh, did you see that story? Where was the mother? And for her to be that person. So, and I think mom realized the outpour of support for the two of us when it all hit the media. And I think that was the one thing she was worried about. And I remember her saying to me, you know, the detective said you can waive it right up to Monday, which was the day of our first court date. And I was like, I can't carry it anymore. So I think from then she knew. And yeah, it was really kind of to protect her and me. But she's at the forefront of my thoughts always.
And I think that's incredible. And I think it's incredible of anyone to go to reporting to court, to go through it alone, whatever their personal decision is. But after all those years of secrecy and shame, you weren't going to hide anything anymore.
Yeah, I just physically couldn't carry it anymore. It was incredible because we had 4 court dates, but we had 3 court appearances because the third one got pushed to the fourth one. And even after the first one, the story was in the news, but there was no names. There was no locations, no telling details. And the amount of people that found out it was me and sent words of support. So I knew from there that it was okay. It was going to be okay.
That must be a mad feeling, though, for the public or your community to get hold of this. Because as I said at the outset, it's not a story. It becomes a news story.
Yeah.
But it's your life.
Yeah. I have multiple groups of friends, small groups of friends. And my closest group, we're called Cheer Squad because we're super cool. And they were all aware. One or two of them maybe knew more details, but no one knew everything. And I always remember the day after the sentencing, and we were still in COVID. There was still, you know, social distancing and all this sort of stuff. And the four girls arrived at my door. And I remember one of them couldn't look me in the eye, just out of pure, I think, shock and hurt for me, maybe. And it was the first time, I think, that I had realized how much it impacted other people. So it doesn't just impact me and my mom. It impacts our friends, our colleagues, all that sort of stuff. And I think that it was such a telling kind of example of how this impacts not just the survivor, but everybody that they know or that they interact with. And I know I've had people, you know, talk to me about it. I've had people say nothing and disappear, which was a really tough pill to swallow at the time. I've had people say nothing and just act like everything is normal. And I've still, to this day, we are 4 years post case now, have still never mentioned it, which is fine. And then you have the people that, and this is the advice I would give anybody, they literally just said, I don't know what to say. That's absolutely fine. You're not looking for people to say anything or to fix anything, but just be normal.
Yeah.
And I think people get really awkward afterwards and you just kind of have to let them be awkward for a little bit and you just carry on the way you've always carried on. If they stick around, they stick around. If they don't, it's not really a loss, even enough to worry about and considering. So,
yeah, people overthink things, don't they? They don't want to say the wrong thing. They don't want to upset you.
Yeah.
So to say nothing, or I even hear in certain situations of people crossing to the other side of the street rather than say the other thing. And how anyone thinks that's going to do anything but impact that other person badly. But it's a tough situation, as you know.
Of course it is. And it's tough for everybody, even for you asking questions. It's awkward. But you forget that we have survived the worst thing imaginable. So we're made of tough stuff. And if we don't want to talk about it, we'll say, no, I don't really feel like talking about it. That doesn't mean we never want to talk about it. God, I don't think I've ever said I don't want to talk about it. I'm pretty much an open book all the time. But it really puts fire in your belly to see how it affects other people, not just you. Just brings a little bit more reality to it. Although it obviously is your reality anyway. But, you know, it widens the circle of impact a little bit more.
And how did you feel going through the court case?
Again, I was very lucky. He pleaded guilty. The most difficult part was walking in on the very first day, because I'd see him for the first time. And that was something, the lovely Cliona from the DRCC, who was my court accompanying person, she rang me the Friday before and she said, is there anything that maybe we'll throw you before, you know, we want to make you as strong as we can going in, which I think is the most incredible tool that they can give you at that time, because you don't know what else to do to help. They can't help you, but they can make sure you are strong and stood high. And I always thought that, you know, it had been 7 years since I saw him and he's been in prison, you know, he'd be frail, he's going to be older, you know, it would have had some physical impact on him. And I was nearly afraid that I would get this pang of sympathy or guilt that he was in that situation. And she was like, okay, that's fine. We'll arrive to court. There's a little glass panel in the door. We can look in through it. When everyone else goes in, he won't see you. You'll see him. Get the wobble over with and we'll walk in. I was like, great. Sounds like a great plan. And then I saw him and he hadn't changed one single bit. It had had zero impact on him. And that threw me, because for me then, and I didn't realize it, that that would throw me. But he was the man that I was afraid of for so long. And the fear returned very rapidly. It was like a sucker punch to the stomach. And he looked me in the eye multiple times and made me look down, which near the end, just before I was giving my victim impact, I was like, come on, Shar, you got to dig deep here. And I stared him down just before I was about to stand and go read my victim impact statement. And it was the most empowering thing I think I've ever done. No, I was shaking, but it was the most empowering experience. And something I'll probably never experience again in my lifetime, that sense of power.
And were you in the courtroom for the sentencing?
Yeah. The sentencing is very, very confusing when you're in there. And I know Cliona had kind of prepped you and she was like, they're going to be throwing numbers at you. Just wait for the final number and that'll be the numbers. So we got a headline of 24 years, which was monumental. I think I remember Kleena saying the next closest one to that was 22 years. So it's probably one of the highest, if not the highest, passed down in the Irish legal system anyway. And then there was 6 years taken off for mitigation because he admitted guilt. He did have no remorse. I know it was something the judge really highlighted, what there was no remorse in him for what he had done, which is not really nice to hear. You kind of want to believe that they're sorry, but he's just not. So there's nothing really else to say on that. There was another year taken off then for like good behavior, whatever. So we're down to 17. And then it was backdated for when he was first arrested for it, which was 2 years. So we're down to 15 and he'll serve 10. So it's something people also need to be aware of, that a third of the sentence is quashed as soon as it begins, which is just heartbreaking. So you read the headline of 17 years and you're like, well, he'll serve 10. He was only in prison for the two before because he was in prison for something else. So you really do feel kind of not hard done by, that's a really awkward phrase, but you just feel like you're not vindicated enough because it gets smaller and smaller. So
it's almost skewed the wrong way. It's not like things are added on because he had gone on to abuse others,
but
because
of
the nature of it or because of the length of time it went on. They're looking on ways to take time. It must be so hard to get your head around, but you were still vindicated and validated and you still stood up and felt empowered in that courtroom. And I suppose that's what you focus on, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I know I do have sometimes kind of, I don't want to say guilt. Guilt's kind of probably the wrong word. But when you see stories in the news of rape victims and their perpetrators get 4 years, and they get 4 years for an isolated one time incident. And I'm like, God, I only got 4 years. And I always remember my mom saying to me, but if you got 4 years for every time it happened to you, you'd be up in the hundreds. And it's so true, but I still know nobody that experiences this should live in fear of their perpetrator. And that's inevitably what happens because their sentences are so short that they're out in the streets in no time. And that is a constant fear for everybody that has ever experienced it. And it's something that I have spoken a lot about to other people. Of late, I've spoken to people that whose perpetrators are being released this year or have been released previously. And it is just that constant paralyzing fear that they'll find you again. And that is, there's no two ways about it. That's the simplest way to put it.
Before I ask you about that with your father, what about the time lapse between you speaking out and it going to court? What do you have to say on that, to have to kind of wait with that?
Yeah, I know, like I was 2 years giving statements. Now I did take a 6 month break in between because I just found it really, really hard. And I have to say, in fairness, the Gardaí were constantly, are you ready yet? Are you ready yet? And not in a bad way, but kind of like I knew they wanted to get this to the DPP, but it was with the DPP then for 18 months. And that was torturous because you don't know if it's going to be taken at that point. So I could have gone through 2 years after already going through 7.5. And they could have said no. So that is, it is paralyzing because you genuinely don't know. You're living with that trepidation for a very long time. Now, I do think mine was an exceptionally long time. I don't think people are waiting that long normally. But I since found out his case file was boxes and boxes and boxes. So they had an awful lot to go through and probably more than in your run-of-the-mill kind of rape case. But something's got to give. Because the time, even the time waiting on court dates, and you get to court and then it's postponed. Now, thankfully, I never got to the courtroom for it to be postponed. It was always postponed before we got there. But people daily are turning up for their hearings and it's getting postponed and it's getting pushed out by months, weeks. And it's torturous. It's just so traumatizing. And I know people don't waive their anonymity. People maybe don't get the outcome that they hope for. But even just to be able to tell their story or have their stories told in a court of law is super important for everybody. And to have that, I'm going to use the word toyed with. It's like dangling a carrot. It's like, oh, it'll happen Monday. Oh, no, actually, it's getting pushed out by 3 weeks, a month, 2 months. It is torturous because it takes a lot to gear yourself up to go in there and to build up to that day. So I know exactly what people are going through when they turn up and they're like, that's not happening. It is exhausting to just physically and mentally prepare yourself for that day is a lot and takes a lot of energy.
Yeah, I think that also needs an overhaul.
Yeah.
So after the sentencing, how did that feel to walk out of the court that day?
I think I floated out, and not in a, you know, a euphoric way, but it was nearly a floating above your own body. Like, is this actually happening? And Nolene in the DRCC, like, she prepped me. She was like, I think it's a good idea for you to do pre-recorded, because then the day is your own then once you're finished. So I had done pre-recorded with two news TV stations, and then I had a few questions to answer outside the court. And then I just walked to my car and I went home and I got changed and I went for dinner. Like, it was just very bizarre. But then, you know, my phone never stopped. Instagram, Facebook, you name it. It was going and going and going. My mom was the same. And of course, then by the time I got to the car, the news was on. I was on the news. I'm like, I've just done the interview. What? How quick is that? You know, it's all very, very quick and very overwhelming. And it can be very overwhelming. So that's why anonymity is such a massive decision, because it is so overwhelming. And you're trying to be pulled in 20 million directions by TV, news, radio, newspapers, everybody. And it can just be very suffocating if you're not prepared for it. Thankfully, I was very much prepared. Sorry, I was prepared to a certain extent. I don't think you can ever be fully prepared, and it can still get a lot and it can feel a lot. But having people in your corner is massively important.
How do you feel now today?
Good. I mean, I think an advocacy journey kind of brings up all the things that are maybe wrong with our system or with how victims and survivors are perceived in this country and how raised on a pedestal maybe perpetrators are sometimes and how much it can impact women. It is a life sentence. It's always going to impact you. Random things can trigger you on any given day. And that's something that people don't think about, I don't think. It is a life sentence. So to have someone ruin your life, essentially, and then get sentenced to 4 years, they'll be out in 2.5, is just, it's nearly making a mockery of your story. And I think maybe that's what stops people coming forward, because it does impact a lot more than just the victim and the perpetrator. There's families and friends to consider in all of that. Not that that should be a consideration to the victim, but it does impact so much. And social media can be just such a damaging place. People just get very brave with their opinions on the comment section, and you forget that we do read those. You know, the victim in that situation does read those and does read your comments. And if you wouldn't say it to someone's face, just don't say it on social media. Just don't put it in writing.
And it's a real story. It's not a storyline in a soap opera.
It's real life. And I think people forget that maybe. You see it all the time. Oh, well, what was she doing? Or, oh, why was she there? Or why did she go back? There are questions you hear all the time. I mean, why did he rape in the first place? Is my question.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, it's a minefield. But there's so many incredible survivors advocating for change. It doesn't look like it's coming very soon, but we are advocating. It does feel like we're fighting a losing battle sometimes, but we are hopeful that we'll get there eventually.
And I think to help other survivors and to flip a switch in someone's brain who thinks, yeah, why would I ask that question? I'm not going to ask that again. And if I hear it around the water cooler at the coffee table, I'm going to stop somebody and I'm going to say it to them too. That is change. They are the seeds of change.
And that is, I know I was involved in the We Consent campaign with the DRCC and the Signs of Hope, which was their latest one for, that was just words of survivors to maybe help other survivors. But it's all about conversation. And I remember going back to when that poor girl, Aisling, was murdered in Tullamore or in Offaly. My friend's brother, always remember, and he is one of the gentlest souls, and he is probably one of the only men that I feel safe around in my life. And I remember him asking, he said, I'm not one of those people. I would never hurt a woman. I would never make derogatory comments, and he wouldn't. And I wholeheartedly say that. But I remember him asking what he can do to help us in that situation. And it was that, call your mates up if they're having a conversation or they make a derogatory joke or comment, call them up on it. Because us women can shout forever, but men like that don't respect us anyway, so they're not going to listen to us, but they will listen to their peers and they will listen to a male voice. And it is men that are probably going to make the change, which is so ironic. But yeah, it's probably going to be men that make the change. And I know very, very conscious that it's not all men, but it's always men. And that's a big thing for us, is that it's always men, and it is men that's going to make the change.
And I know you live a full life and you're
very busy
here to the studio. You know, I think people would pass you in the street, and unless they fully recognized you, perhaps from your TV interviews or newspaper, they would have no clue about what had gone on.
Yeah.
But you just said something there that really struck me, that that's one of the only men you trust. So you really are still living a life sentence. It's something that you will always carry.
Yeah. And I actually only said it the other day. I'm 36 now. So this month, half of my life has spent now as a survivor of rape, which is bizarre. And it is something that really struck a chord with me the other day. I was like, I've literally lived half my life in fear of this man. And I do still fear him. I have another 6 years before he's released, which is terrifying. But it lives with you forever. And my life changed 18 years ago. But I don't care if I have to spend the rest of my life trying to fight for change, because no one should live in fear of anybody. And that is something that survivors do every day, every day.
Well, I'm so sorry that you went through even a second of what you went through, but I cannot believe that your spirit wasn't stamped out through it all, that
you are
here, such an incredible person, and speaking so beautifully about it all and pushing for change. It takes a very strong and special person, and it's been a pleasure to spend time with you to help you to do that. So, Charlene, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're now going to be joined by the DRCC CEO, Rachel Morrow, to help us further understand the prevalence of sexual assault and rape in Ireland and what more needs to be done. Rachel, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
A very powerful conversation with Charlene there. And I was sharing with you and producer Siobhan. I always want to make sure that in this podcast, we do each survivor story justice, that we ask the right questions, that we hold the correct space, and that we give them an opportunity to push for change. So I'm really glad that I'm getting to do that and that you are here to join now after it. And Charlene did say how supported she felt by the DRCC in helping her and preparing her for court and coming to terms with what had happened to her. And sadly, Charlene is not an isolated incident.
First of all, Charlene is an amazing, amazing person, and I'm so glad that everyone has heard her speak and can probably, some of us can relate to some of her experiences in terms of, you know, dealing with the justice system, maybe some of the stigma that you fear, the shame and the blame that may come with sexual violence. And also, I think Charlene's story shows that sexual violence isn't any one thing, like that image that some of us have around sexual violence just being rape, and rape happens in a dark alley in a dark night by a stranger. Whereas Charlene's story shows that her experience was so different. And that's why we're so grateful to her for sharing her story and explaining to people that no matter what your experience is, that it's valid and that there's support out there. And I suppose Dublin Rape Crisis Centre runs the National Rape Crisis Helpline. We've been doing that for 45 years. So there's no story that we haven't heard before. And we really want people to feel empowered that they don't have to bear the trauma of sexual violence alone. If they call the National Rape Crisis Helpline, they don't need to go to the guards. If that's not what they want, they can just tell someone else what happened. And for some people, that's enough. And for others, it'll start them on a different healing journey.
Why can there be so much shame? Anyone I've ever heard speak has said that they also questioned, why was I there? Why did I do X, Y, Z? When that isn't the question, the question is, why did the perpetrator do what they did? Is that a normal psychological human reaction in the shock, do you think? Because I wonder, does that keep victims stuck, that they question their own behavior and feel others will judge them. And that's what silences them.
It's a very protective silence for perpetrators, and it allows them to hide in plain sight. And this silence has been created by social conditions where we don't like to blame the perpetrator. We want to say, well, he or she was drinking or taking drugs. And I suppose it's not up to the victim to try and avoid being raped. Rape is what someone does to someone else, and the perpetrator is 100% to blame for that. And we've seen some cases recently in the media where there has been a strong message sent, particularly to victims who maybe are living under that shroud of stigma and maybe haven't come forward yet, that they are hopefully starting to realize that they were in no way to blame for what happened. And again, there are supports out there, whether that is going for counseling and therapy or the helpline or any of the other services and supports that are out there. We're really trying to encourage people to reach out for them. And we know that it's difficult, but if you're in contact with a rape crisis center, you're never going to be blamed for what happened. We're always going to understand, and we're always going to explain that it was never, ever your fault. But these social conditions have been built up for centuries and centuries. And I was reading a book and it described our lack of wanting to blame the perpetrator as himpathy, that we have like this concern that the perpetrator, if it's a man, we are kind of conditioned to sympathize with him, that, oh, you know, he was blamed for something that maybe he didn't do. We have these rape myths that surround all of society that are amplified now on social media. We are looking for someone to blame. And in the case of sexual violence, it's so perverse that we blame the victim. And I can think of no other instance where that happens.
And that perpetuates the silence, doesn't it? I mean, people might be forgiven for thinking it's a fairly innocuous comment. Charlene spoke about reading the comments and seeing people say, why didn't she leave? Where was her mother? Why didn't she tell her mother? And you may think this is an innocent comment you make, but not only is it really hurting and impacting the victim survivor, but it's also self-perpetuating this stigma that we have of victim blaming, and that keeps that societal norm going. We really need to start changing that conversation. Those comments need to stop. They're not innocuous at all.
When you think about the fact that one in two survivors of sexual violence have never told anyone and will never tell another person, then when you put those comments out on the internet, you can imagine that for the person in question, the survivor who sees them and who they relate to, there are many, many others who are watching and looking at that. And it sends a really negative message to them that they're right. You know, this isn't a safe space to disclose what happened to them. And that's why, again, we're really encouraging people to reach out to those safe supports that are out there and to start that healing journey. Because what we're worried about is that those one in two people, the people who aren't telling anyone, that they are facing the trauma of sexual violence alone, and that can have lifelong and devastating consequences.
And Charlene spoke of continuing to carry a life sentence herself, of always having that, because so much was taken from her, but she was still free of the secret, and she was still free of his control over that situation. And that's important. And I'm saying that without judgment for anyone who stays silent, because I understand where that fear must be coming from. But to take control is something that everybody deserves of their own life.
They do deserve it. And I think that Charlene's story and her empowerment when that guilty verdict was reached, and what she's doing now, years later, that she's still advocating for survivors of sexual violence. And any of the survivors that I've spoken to are so passionate about changing the future, that they really feel that we're at an inflection point and that the future can be changed. And they are so right, because sexual violence is something that can be prevented. It is one person committing an awful act on someone else. And in that respect, suspect we could stop sexual violence tomorrow if we stopped perpetrators from committing these crimes. But unfortunately, that's not within our gift. What we have to do is change society and change culture and make sure that we're all committed to that future where our daughters and our sons have a better place to live and a better place to be and to live their life free of sexual violence. And that's, I think, incumbent on all of us as adults to really prioritise that and do what we can within our own lives, whether that's calling out bad behaviour when we see it. It could be in a WhatsApp group, could be on social media, could be in our friend or family group. That's where it starts. That's where the cultural change starts. Turning your head and saying, you know, that doesn't affect me. That's not a big issue. That's not okay, because we don't know who's going to be affected by this issue and we don't know who has been affected by this issue. And when we are in our friend and family groups, there are undoubtedly people who've been affected by sexual violence, and maybe they just haven't named it, maybe they just haven't spoken about it. So let's be that safe person, let's be an ally and figure out what we can do to help them and support them in the same way that Charlene said her friends did for her.
What about the legal process then? Because that obviously is something that needs a complete overhaul. For somebody to speak out and then to feel like they're not believed or they're not heard, or to perhaps not even get to go to trial, that needs to change.
There are a lot of challenges with the legal process. And the first one is that these very, very, very significant number of survivors who even report to the Gardaí is really, really low. It's around 5% of people who've been affected by sexual violence. So it's tiny. And then that number gets smaller and smaller as you go along the justice pathway. So there absolutely needs to be a focus on that. And that's something that Dublin Rape Crisis Centre has been focusing on. I think that when the legal system does work, there is, like Charlene said, there is that sense of relief and, again, empowerment and that vindication that justice was realised and that actually somebody believes them and somebody is going to pay a price for the crime they committed. And equally, for everybody who doesn't go the justice route, either because they can't or they don't want to, they look to those outcomes from trials and they, I think, pin hopes to them as well that maybe the system is changing and you can get that vindication and that guilty verdict. And I think also increasingly we're seeing quite lengthy sentences, which we hope is sending a very strong message to the perpetrators who are out there that they can't run from this.
The sentencing issue is something that Charlene brought up as well, and it was incredulous to me that there would be years taken off for good behaviour for a man who had abused his daughter for years on end. That does send out a message to society.
I think there is often a conflict between what we as members of society want and what the justice system is able to deliver or is set up to deliver. And we do hear about how disappointing and crushing it can be, like even around the character references, that there is this element of good behaviour that, you know, he did this awful thing, but actually he's a great guy in the rest of his life. And how is that possible? You're not two people, you're one person. And just because you're hiding the really awful, poisonous, nasty side of you doesn't mean that it's not there. And I think, as you said earlier, Claire, we're still hearing those words shame and blame, and that sometimes the justice system can apply those feelings on victims, on survivors who are using the justice system. So I think that there's lots of challenges along that pathway, but I also think that there is an increasing momentum behind the change that's needed, and hopefully that can happen sooner rather than later.
I just want to remind people of the stats again. If we have one in two people will experience sexual violence in their lifetime and won't tell anybody, that means that everybody who's listening to this now knows somebody. And I think that's quite shocking to people. There's three of us in this room now, and that means there's one of us. That's even very arresting for me. Is it human nature that we want to protect ourselves from the darkness of life? That's why I say we, but I don't include myself in that, turn to the victim and think, oh, well, maybe they shouldn't have walked home alone, or that's quite dangerous, because that's a safer place to be than to shine a light on the darkness of somebody who would attack another, not just down a dark alley, but known to them or over long periods of time. Is that what it is? And is that where we need to start shining that light and let that fear go? Because otherwise, we'll never have change in this area.
We absolutely need to shine a light on it. And I think we have to just start doing things and talking about the issues that affect survivors of sexual violence. And yes, I think part of it is naming that wide range of things which makes up the umbrella term of sexual violence. Like, what actually is it? And when you start to name the things that make up that umbrella, people will probably put their hand up and say, that happened to me, and like, that made me feel awful. And I think that particularly as women, we do have kind of a feeling of inevitability about it sometimes, that maybe it's like something that just happens to women, but it shouldn't be something that just happens to us. We don't ever deserve it. Nobody deserves any form of sexual violence, including men as well. Like, one in five men will experience sexual violence in their life. So although it is something that's quite gendered, I would hate to think that because we focus on women quite a lot, that makes men feel that they can't come forward too. So I think it's about really having a very wide conversation and talking to our children about it as well, and making sure that they understand the harm that sexual violence causes. And I think that those conversations are particularly important with our boys, so that they understand what role they have in preventing future incidents of sexual violence. And then with our girls as well, so that they know that if anything does happen to them, where to go for help and support, and that they know that they don't have to put up with anything, that it's not right, and that we have a justice system that will support them.
How do you remain hopeful in this work, Rachel, or do you?
I do remain hopeful, and that's because every survivor that I have met has been hopeful themselves. They talk about the future that we're all working towards, and that's the future where sexual violence is eliminated. And I think that, you know, even talking to friends and family and work colleagues, we all feel that this is something that can be tackled, and that there is hope. And there's hope certainly with the people who come to Dublin Rape Crisis Centre for support. I worry about the ones who haven't reached out for support. So those one in two who are dealing with the trauma themselves at home, I do worry about them. And my message always would be that if you are one of those people, and even if you don't think that you deserve the help or that we can help, perhaps you think that, you know, we only help people who have experienced rape itself, like a very narrow part of sexual violence. That is simply not the case. We will support anybody. If they reach their hand out, we will grab it and we will pull them up.
Because I think even with Charlene's story, people will be surprised to have to get their head around Charlene's abuse began with that first text message. And it's any behaviour like that is not okay. You're right, it doesn't have to be that attack in the street or that eventual rape, anything leading up to that. So you welcome all of those calls where somebody has felt violated in any way, and there are professionals at the end of that line who know this area sadly inside and out and are only there to support you.
Absolutely. And the service is for the entire country. It's a national rape crisis helpline. But whatever has happened to somebody, we can support them. Even if when we talk to that person, we think that we're not the right organisation for them, we will signpost them to somewhere else. But certainly the first port of call is that free phone number, 1-800-77-88-88. It's open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So even for people who are waking up with night terrors in the middle of the night, or they can't get to sleep, we're there for them. Those are the type of calls we take every single day. Very, very experienced crisis counsellors on the end of the phone for whoever who needs them.
Someone who was huge in Charlene's story was her friend who asked her outright, and also the dance teacher who had noticed and started to ask questions. What's your advice to people who may be worried about people in their life?
Ask the question. Ask them, are they okay? And keep on asking the question. I think that the Charlene has spoken so openly about how that friend, she opened so many doors for her in terms of her disclosing what happened, and she kept on offering those doors. And eventually Charlene did walk through one of them. And I think that we are, you know, we can say that we're great friends, but in times of need, sometimes we're not always there for people. And I think in an age where there's lots of voice notes and not real conversations going on, if you haven't heard from a friend in a while, or you just have something, some kind of niggling doubt, just ask the question. And if you are worried about someone, the helpline, we don't just deal with survivors, victims. We also often take calls from parents who are worried, friends, frontline service providers. Whatever situation you're in, we can help.
Well, what you do is incredible. Thank you to you and to all of your team. Rachel Morrow, DRCC CEO, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Claire.
We have begun to talk so much more about victim blaming and shaming and how wrong this is. We've stepped away from judging anyone from what they wear to where they walked or decisions they made in the lead up to a sexual assault. We thankfully accept that the perpetrator is the only one at fault. However, since Charlene spoke so candidly about reading comments online questioning what she went through, I've been asking myself the question she asked. Why are they questioning what I did or didn't do? Why aren't they questioning what he did? But the more conversations we have, the more we take away shame and stigma, shining a light into the dark, the more we can begin to move forward. Coming up next on Breaking the Silence, we'll be focusing on reporting a sexual attack to the guards.
You know, I never thought that this is how my life would turn out, or that, you know, my husband was going to go to jail. You couldn't even believe it, you know, but obviously, you know, his actions is what put him there. I didn't put him there.
Breaking the Silence is a News Talk original podcast in conjunction with the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. It's produced by Siobhan Walsh and hosted by me, Claire McKenna. If you need help, you can contact the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre on their national helpline by calling 1800 77888. Thank you.